That was a beautiful introduction.
That's very elegant.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I'm going to talk about how mass assembles in the universe and what that might have to do with the structure of dark matter halos and the galaxies that form in them. So, those are some of the people that I've worked with on various parts of this. A lot of this is in collaboration with James Bullock. So when you look at the massive sky that we see, there's all kinds of things that you notice, and you know, some of the big questions that we have when we look at these things are really just what determines galaxy properties and their evolution. Why do they have the properties that they do, and also why do they seem to exhibit all these very tight scaling relations, like the Tully-Fisher relation and the fundamental plane, which relates the rotation of the galaxy to its luminosity. And there are various other interesting scaling relations, such that, including the fact that red early type galaxies seem to live in dense regions, and colors and magnitudes seem to be correlated, metallicities and stellar masses seem to be correlated. So we'd like to try to understand all these things and to also understand what determines variation in these properties with environment. Those are hard questions. And I think something that's a slightly easier question that we're starting to really get a fairly good handle on recently is what determines the variation and evolution of dark matter halo properties. So essentially, looking at the halo mass assembly history, its accretion and merging history, and there's probably some process, there must be some process that translates this into galaxy observables. But there's a lot that happens along the way. And that involves both the structure of the dark matter halos, their density profiles and their angular momentum profiles, for example, and various baryonic processes and gas infall, star formation rate, feedback, which I think we're understanding is more and more important. So we don't really yet understand the connections between these things. I think, you know, some of these are fairly clear. The accretion rate probably, I'm going to tell you, relates to the density profiles, probably also relates to the gas infall rate. I'm going to explain how some of these things might be correlated, but it's really, you know, it may be this messy. And the basic point is, we at this point, we still don't know, and we'd like to figure out what happens here. Just as a sort of side issue that we should keep in the back of our mind, CDM has been really remarkably successful over the past few years, but there are some indications that there are problems on small scales. So is there a problem? What are those problems? One possible problem is that the density profiles seem to be, that cold dark matter predicts, seem to be too steep in the center compared to the rotation curves of some galaxies. There are other indications that halos of mostly disk galaxies are too concentrated, even if they're not too cuspy. And there's a possible problem with the amount of substructure, but I really think that this has pretty much gone away. I think that reionization essentially solves this problem fairly well. But you should keep in mind that whatever solution you come up to with for these problems better still help you with the, better still be consistent with the amount of substructure when you include the relevant baryonic processes.
Reionization is very good at ionizing gas in a potential well with a velocity of 10 parts a second.
That's right.
Sounds like hydrogen. But what if you have a potential well with, say, 50 parts a second, which is still a dwarf galaxy? Reionization is not going to do much to the gas in that
way. Yeah, I think I think the people who have looked at this in detail find that it works. It helps you up to about 30 kilometers a second. Mm-hmm. And if there's really a problem at 50 kilometers a second, I don't think reionization can solve that. Mm-hmm. But it's not clear to me that there is a problem at 50. So.
There might well be. I mean, you know, we have quite a lot of dwarfs in the local group. The LNC is probably 100. The SMC is closer to 50. So.
Right.
Very, you know, relatively few that are observed.
Right.
More, I think, than we predicted.
You're suggesting that there may be more existing.
I'm not sure. I know the problem's been solved for the below 30, but I just wonder what happened in 30 and 200, whether your community.
Yeah, I didn't actually bring a plot, although I have one in some other thing I could show you. I don't think there's a serious problem there, but it's not completely clear at this point. Okay, so what about this issue of the centers of dark matter halos? So just to remind those of you who aren't familiar with this, essentially, as I'll talk about in more detail in a minute, the prediction for the shape of dark matter halos, the density profile looks like this. It goes like r to the minus 1 in the center. This is the prediction from detailed n-body simulations. And there's been considerable disagreement about this slope, but let me just remind you that almost all of that disagreement has been in the inner kiloparsec. And there's still some disagreement, although less than there used to be. I think now, essentially, to sum up, my opinion is that where people agree, it still looks NFW. Below that, it's not clear. But anyways, it's really only the very inner part that seems to be ambiguous. And it's also the inner part of these rotation curves that seems to be ambiguous. So here's an example of the possible problem. These points are from a rotation curve of this particular dwarf galaxy. This is from a conference proceeding that Stacy McGaugh had. And these are various fits to this profile. And the basic point is, essentially, in here, there's too much dark matter. And if you try to fit something that matches better there, even the best fit NFW profiles seem to give very low concentrations. But I think there's still some considerable disagreement about the observational situation. There's a paper which I have not yet seen. It's only a rumor, but it's been submitted to the APJ, in which Swatters et al., I think Mador and Vandenbosch and somebody. Essentially, they have a fairly large sample, and they claim that 3/4 of their sample is consistent with NFW halos. And the remaining quarter may have non-circular motion, so that the central part of the rotation curve is not really being adequately sampled. Okay, so I personally think that right now it's better to think of this problem as a central density problem and not a problem about the inner slopes. So let's just, I'm remaining agnostic about the issue of the inner slope, but even with that caveat, there's still a possible problem that halos are too dense at some radius. So this is the same kind of data that I was talking about before from low surface brightness and dwarf galaxy rotation curves. But now, instead of concentrating on the inner slope, I'm looking at the overdensity at the radius where the rotation curve reaches half its maximum value. Okay, so this is a somewhat more robust measure that doesn't depend on how you define the profile shape. And this is what the data looks like, and this line is the standard for lambda CDM. And essentially, you can see that, so these dashed lines are the 68% spread in halos of this maximum rotation velocity. And you can see the data is lying somewhat low, but it's not drastically low. Okay. So this is a possible problem, at least with the sort of standard CDM. There's another indication of the sort of the same problem from the rotation curves of just normal disk galaxies. So this is a plot of the Tully-Fisher relation. This is data from Bell and DeYoung, and this is a model where James Bullock made this plot. It's essentially just taking the dark matter halos, assuming adiabatic contraction. So again, this is the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation. But essentially, what you see is that for a given luminosity, halos are rotating too fast. If you look not at the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation, you know, and play with the mass-to-light ratio, you can do probably better at matching it. But it's a slightly tuning game, and most people who run detailed semi-analytic models are having trouble simultaneously matching the Tully-Fisher relation and the luminosity function. So just briefly, there have been all kinds of proposed solutions for these problems, and some of them are more drastic than others. I think one promising one is just to have some slight modification of the power spectrum, essentially by just lowering, keeping CDM, but just lowering the power on small scales, either by adding a tilt or lowering sigma 8. And Zentner and Bullock also investigated other inflation models, including the model Kamienkowski and somebody. anyways, so the basic idea being that if you lower this power, you can get down. So this is an example of how well you can do with sigma 8 of 0.8 and a small tilt. Okay, but there's also possible other solutions, such as angular momentum transfer or somehow clearing out the inner region by some sort of coupling process. And I'm also going to talk about the possibility that there are some selection effects in this data, okay, that these are not a normal representative sample of halos. Right, so I think in evaluating all those solutions, we should keep in mind whether those problems apply to all galaxy-size halos and whether they apply for all mass scales. Basically, those different solutions will have different predictions on different scales. So the key thing in order to be able to do this is to really understand what sets the halo density profiles. Okay, so most of you know this, but this is the NFW profile that I've been talking about. Essentially, at the center, it looks like r to the minus 1, and the outskirts, it looks like r to the minus 3, and there's some scale radius, which I call RS, where the density profile turns over. And I'm going to be talking a lot about a concentration parameter, which is just defined as the virial radius divided by this scale radius. And this is roughly 10 for typical size halos. So a major advance in understanding this was in this paper, which was published, I guess, just last year, where in a lambda CDM cosmology, the density profiles were actually measured for thousands of halos over a fairly wide mass range and a fairly wide redshift range. And essentially, the point is that there's this mass trend, but there's a large scatter in this mass trend there's a large scatter in concentration for a given mass. There's also a strong redshift trend, so concentration seems to go as 1 over 1 plus z. Okay. So we'd like to understand what's responsible for these trends and also what's responsible for the scatter in C. At a given mass, essentially what determines C for individual halos. And if we can understand that, maybe we can understand how it's related to galaxies. So in order to do this, this is part of my thesis work in Santa Cruz, I built this, what I call a structural merger tree. So the novel thing about this as a merger tree, people have started playing this game of extracting merger trees from simulations. The interesting thing about this merger tree is that not only do I have the merging history for thousands of halos, I also have information about the structure of the halos. So I have fits to the density profile for every little halo that's pictured on this plot. So this plot is supposed to represent, this is the merging history of two different mass halos. This is redshift 0, this is high redshift. And these little red circles are just representing the RS in these halos. Okay. So for every halo, I have a measurement of their RS, of their RVR, and also of their angular momentum properties. Okay. And I have this for a statistical sample of halos. This was made possible by this very nice adaptive refinement tree code developed by Andrei Kratsov and Anatoly Klipin. So here, this is a 60 megaparsec box.
Why did they taper off high redshift?
Yeah, that's just a resolution issue. Right, so I mean this halo right here was only say 10 to the 10 solar masses and that its progenitor at higher redshift was much lower mass. So this plots all halos above a given mass threshold, right? And that's also why this plot is much less full than this plot.
So all the rest of the stuff
is below the mass threshold. That's right.
But the thought is, if you didn't have that limitation, it would just continue to grow.
That's right. That's right.
So the size of your circles is proportional?
So the size of the outer circle is proportional to the virial radius, and the size of the inner circle is proportional to the scale radius RS.
Are you going to talk why this will at some stage always?
So that essentially happens. Well, there are two things. I mean, the main thing is that when halos merge, you get for a short period of time, you do physically get a much larger RS.
Right.
So that's what's happening here. So this halo just experienced a fairly reasonably sized merger, and I'm probably measuring this before it's really relaxed.
What about the other one? The other one's much smaller.
Yeah, well, mistakes happen. The universe is messy.
I guess I don't understand.
Yeah.
It's not relaxed and you don't have the NFM. And what is the definition of RS?
Okay, so we fit an NFW profile essentially to every halo above, if it's above 200 particles, so 2 times 10 to the 11. Okay, now sometimes it's a really bad fit. Most of the time it's a good fit, but sometimes, especially right here, this is probably a concentration that has very high errors. But in all this analysis, we actually have errors on the fits, and we keep track of that. So it's true that sometimes the NFW profile is not a good fit when it's relaxed. But
so can you use this data to study or try to figure out why an NFW profile works?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can get some insight into it.
So you got tons of these things.
That's right.
They're running into each other, and for some reason, NFW seems to keep that popping out.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I'm going to tell you, you know, how robustly to set the concentration, but I think you're right that we can learn more than we already have about what's responsible for the NFW profile from this data.
Did you take the simulation, take each of your halos, and then take all the particles out and put them back in with a different concentration, different density profile than you have?
Keep the halos?
Yeah, so like a redshift 0.557. Take all the...
Oh.
No simulation. Take all the particles out of each halo.
Uh-huh. Redistribute the particles.
Yeah.
In some other halo,
yeah.
And see whether they relax to NFW.
Yeah.
Yeah, one could do that. Yeah, no, I mean, that would be interesting.
It looks as though at redshift 3, you just have only very small galaxies. Is that?
That's right. So the resolution of this plot is 2 times 10 to the 11 solar masses. So I actually track halos down a factor of 10 lower than that, but I don't fit concentrations because it's just too difficult. It gets too messy. Hopefully next month we have another simulation with about an order of magnitude more resolution. So.
But you're wondering why there aren't any clusters?
No, I'm just wondering why we see enormous amounts of massive galaxies at redshifts 3 and 4.
Well,
The Lyman Break galaxies.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Lyman Break galaxies, I mean, okay, so here, right, these are progenitors of a Milky Way halo. The Lyman Break galaxies are not progenitors of a Milky Way size halo.
No, but they're clustered. They might fit better into
cluster objects. Sure. Well, I mean, I've actually looked at this problem in detail about the Lyman Break galaxies. And I mean, the halos, I don't think there's any problem. I mean, I think the halos that host them are there and are abundant enough. Okay, so one of the first things that I did was to look at what the mass accretion histories look like. This is just 8 sort of randomly selected halos. I'm plotting here just the evolution of the most massive progenitor, so that's that left branch of the tree in the previous plot. Okay, so I'm just tracking the most massive progenitor back through time. This is redshift 0. This is redshift 4. And you can see that as you might expect, halos are very rapidly accreting mass at early times and slowly at late times. And it turns out that these mass accretion histories for all the halos are fairly well fit by a very simple functional form, which is just that M naught is the final mass of the halo. This is just an exponential. This is where AC is some scale factor. I define that scale factor to be the time when the log slope of this function is equal to 2. Okay, and that's a somewhat arbitrary parameter, but it works sensibly for other reasons. So, of course, in detail, these things are somewhat messy. You know, things have major mergers. But on average, this form works very, very well, and you'll see in a minute why else it's particularly satisfying. I should point out that around the same time, Frank Vandenbosch did some similar stuff just looking at the mass accretion histories in extended press Schechter, which don't have exactly the same functional form as I'll tell you, but he essentially finds that a form very similar to this is universal over a large range of cosmologies as well. Okay. So this is just looking at the average mass accretion history for different mass spins. This is high mass halos, which on average form late, low mass halos, which on average form early.
I guess I can't tell from this what the mass of the object is that's accreted. This is just the mass of the central object growing.
That's right.
So what
you can't tell from this.
So what is primarily accreting? Many very small things or a few bigger things?
It actually does seem to be mostly in smaller things.
What about most of the mass?
Most of the mass does not come in very large mergers. Most of the mass, I think, comes in essentially minor mergers.
And what mass ratio? I mean, I guess you can't resolve that, but...
Yeah, I've tried to answer this question, and I essentially don't feel like my simulation is good enough to give a robust answer. So I'm working on this, actually, this week. Okay, so it turns out that this history is related to the evolution of concentration. So now instead of bidding these things by mass range, I'm bidding them by that parameter AC, which I defined. Okay, and so these are the late forming ones. These are the early forming ones, and you can see that those three bins have very different histories for their average concentration. Okay, so this is the average evolution of the early forming halos. They end up having substantially higher concentrations and actually evolving somewhat more rapidly. And it turns out that this concentration can be related to this formation scale factor in the way that I've defined it in a very, very simple way. It's just inversely proportional. So this is for halos greater than 10 to the 12 at redshift 0. And I put different symbols in here to denote the ones that had a merger since redshift 2 and the ones that didn't, just to try to convince you that those seem to lie on roughly the same line. The details of the merging history actually don't seem to be very important for setting the concentration. Okay? So I mean, there is some scatter about this line, but there are substantial measurement errors in both of these parameters, right? Here I'm attempting to fit an NFW profile, which is not necessarily perfect. Here I'm attempting to fit that one parameter mass accretion history. Okay, so there are errors in both of these parameters, but essentially this trend holds very well, and it turns out that it holds... The same exact trend holds very well for other mass ranges and other redshifts. So concentrate just on the red points at first. Those are redshift 0 halos, now in four different mass bins. And you can see that they essentially all lie on the same line. Now what I do at high redshift is I just fit the past mass accretion history, okay? and I then scale that, so I get some scaled formation scale factor, and so these are redshift 1 halos, these are redshift 2 halos, and they seem to lie on exactly the same line. So this is very nice. The scatter at a given mass and redshift seems to be caused almost exclusively by scattering in these mass accretion histories. Okay, so you might think that it was correlated with some kind of galaxy properties. Just a little bit more about this formation scale factor. So the way I've defined it, right, it's independent of the mass, right? Any given mass halo has some time, which is its characteristic time for forming. And so that's independent of redshift. Okay, and that's what allows me to get this very nice scaling. If I defined formation time in some standard way such that it was just the time when the halo had some fraction of its current mass, that kind of definition doesn't scale in any sort of self-similar way. So as I go farther and farther back, that redshift gets farther back but also gets closer to the time because halos are more rapidly accreting. So this definition allows you something that's redshift independent. So the fact that you see the same trend at these different redshifts is essentially what allows you to have the concentration go as A over AC. Okay, so the other point of this plot is that the scatter in AC for a given mass halo is exactly equivalent to the scatter in CVir. It's roughly 0.14 in the log. 0.13 in the log. Well, it's 0.13 here. It's 0.14 in CVir. So again, I don't claim to have measured any of these things perfectly, but to the extent that I can measure both AC and CVir in my simulation, AC basically accounts for CVir.
Okay. I have a question. These two measurements are not independent, right? Because in order to have a good concentration, you need a logarithmic and y kind of profile. And in order to have a well-defined formation time, you need that.
You don't need an FR Frankenweight profile.
Or you need something that is relaxed, at least, that does not
okay.
create something opposite.
Yeah.
So these two things are not totally independent. And you might imagine that
it's
arrows go in the same way, and that gives you some of that.
Some of the trend?
Yeah.
The number of halos for which it's very bad is relatively small. So I don't think that that's a major contribution.
No, I want that to
and
be,
it's,
expect that to be the case for small halos, right? I mean, less than Milky Way stuff.
Okay, yeah.
That would be much more severe.
Sure, but if you look at the very massive halos where we have 10,000 particles and we really can resolve the mass accretion history, it's clear that we see that trend.
Right, but those are the one would expect that they have already relaxed, etc.
Well, no, I don't think that massive halos, I mean, the massive halos may or may not have relaxed, just because they're massive. I mean, they're actually forming mass more rapidly, right?
But they're centered, which should be much, I mean,
generally. Yeah, yeah. I don't think I can tell. It does seem to have somewhat decreased in at redshift 0 in these couple bins, but I'm not sure whether that's a real. There's not enough halos to tell. Here, I mean, these error bars are Poisson on the number of halos in the bin, so I don't really trust the scatter on these two points.
This is a lambda CDM.
This is lambda CDM. Sigma 8 of 1. So, no, I'm sorry, it's 0.9. Sorry. Anyways, we have not yet tested this in detail for other cosmologies, and that's work in progress. I think this relation really, you know, gives some credence to this model that was developed by Bullock et al. Essentially, that because it turns out that this accretion, this formation time that I've defined is equivalent to the formation time in the Bullock et al. Recipe. It's essentially for the right choice of parameters, it's the same as the time when this mass halo was some fraction of M star.
So your capital S and capital F, those are just your Fermi parameters.
Right. So S was the parameter that I chose to define AC. Okay. I could have defined it differently. And I would have this would shift up or down. F is just the parameter that I got to fit this line. I just fit this line. So this is essentially the Bullock et al. Model where this mass, this is the time when this mass was M star over F. Okay, and that I've just chosen for that model. Okay, so just to emphasize that you know the mass accretion history really predicts the whole density profile. So essentially now there are three ingredients to this model. There's the NFW profile, there's this form for the mass accretion history, and there's this relation between them. And I just use this to just analytically show how various things scale. This is for two halos which have the same final time and different characteristic formation times. And essentially, here I plot their mass accretion rate. And the other interesting thing is, in some sense, it might be more relevant to talk about how RS scales, right? So as C is defined, it goes as RVR, right? RVR goes as one over one plus Z. So essentially, what's going on in terms of the redshift scaling is that once a halo has formed, its RS essentially stays constant. Okay. And the basic picture here was, I think, solidified a little bit by this recent paper, where they looked at the energies of the particles in this sort of fast accretion rate when you're on this steeply rising part of the exponential, and this slow accretion phase when you're essentially just accreting mass very slowly. And in this fast accretion rate, you're really getting something like violent relaxation. The halo energies are really mixing. And later on, when you're just slowly accreting, you're essentially just building mass up on the outside.
And how do you define fast versus slow accretion?
Well, they define it in a way, I mean, I would essentially define it as before and after this AC parameter. Zhao et al. Claim that there's actually some critical point. I don't know. I'm not yet convinced that it's well defined. But they're essentially saying that exponential is broken up into two phases. They actually define it, I think, as the time when the velocity dispersion of the particles within RS is equal to the velocity dispersion of the halo, of all of the halo particles. Okay, so I'm going on too long, so I'm just going to skip very quickly through this. I just wanted to mention that, so in principle, you would like to predict these concentrations using mass accretion histories that you got from EPS. And I just want to remind you that EPS, although it works fairly well, does not work perfectly well. So what I found when I looked at this parameter AC was that EPS has systematically later formation times than my simulated halos. Okay. So the red is the distribution in different mass ranges for simulated halos. The green is what I get for EPS. And it not only has this systematic offset, but it also has slightly the wrong shape. So that at small lookback times, the progenitors that EPS predicts are too massive, and at large lookback times, they're not massive enough.
How do you do EPS? Do you construct a merger tree?
Yeah, so this is actually constructing a merger tree using essentially Somerville and Collot. But I think that this problem is generic. The basic problem is generic to any way that you to EPS itself and not to the method of constructing the merger tree. So I don't really want to get into this, but no one's really figured out a way to solve this problem yet. But in this case, for predicting concentrations, what I found was that this seemed to have a constant offset as a function of mass, this parameter AC, even though the shape is slightly wrong. Essentially, so these blue points are what I get from EPS. The green, the red points are from simulated halos. And so if I just offset these by a factor of 25% in AC, I can essentially match the mass dependence and the scatter in the simulations using an EPS merger tree. So that's not terribly satisfying, but it seems to work fairly well. So just to emphasize how it works, so these are now the blue points are the concentrations that I've estimated from extended press sector in this mass range. And in EPS, it was encouraging for me to find that this AC parameter is still constant with redshift, okay, in the way that it seemed to be in simulations. So just to emphasize, because this is a slightly confusing point, in the Bullock et al. Paper, they said that C vir goes as 1 over 1 plus C for halos of a fixed mass. Okay, and we still are finding that. But my recipe would tell you that it also goes as 1 over 1 plus Z on average for individual halos. Okay, that's a slightly confusing point, but both of those facts are true. Okay. And that point of that last slide was just to tell you that you should be careful about EPS histories because they do predict slightly late formation times. So, okay. So, what might this whole relation of concentration and density have to do with galaxies? Well, I showed you that early forming halos are high concentration, and I didn't demonstrate convincingly, but high concentration halos are also more clustered. High concentration halos are going to host galaxies with steeper rotation curves just because of the potential well. And because they form early, I would suggest that it's likely that they have early star formation and possibly higher surface brightness and higher metallicities. So just as a sort of toy model for this, I did the following very simple calculation. I generated some extended press sector trees. And this is for a sample of essentially Milky Way size halos, and I just assumed that the old stars in my galaxies would be things that formed in progenitor halos more massive than some mass at high redshift. Okay, and the mass I chose at redshift 3 was 2 × 10⁸ because that's the minimum mass halo that can possibly form stars at that redshift, essentially due to atomic line cooling. And then I also calculated the concentration from the most massive progenitor of that. And this is the kind of correlation that I find. Okay. So this is really just a fairly simplistic argument, but it makes the basic point that, you know, the things that are in old, the things that host old stars are going to live in very concentrated halos. Okay. So, of course, I'd like to do a little bit. Well, let me just justify that very briefly. These are some plots from an SPH simulation by Morali and Katz and Weinberg and Hernquist. And essentially, this shows the mass accretion rate and the star formation rate. And you can see that these things, as a function of time, are very tightly correlated. Okay, and in fact, more tightly correlated than this is with the merger rate. So I think this basic idea that what we really understand fairly well is that the mass accretion rate is going to correlate fairly strongly with the star formation rate. So I wanted to include these kind of recipes into more detailed galaxy formation models. So as most of you know, there's a whole industry that predicts detailed galaxy properties based on based on a halo merging history and simple recipes for galaxy formation. So it includes physics of gas cooling and reheating and star formation, stellar population synthesis, feedback modeling, and somewhat crude modeling of disks and spheroids. None of these models that have been published to date have included any information about the halo structure other than their mass, essentially. So in these models, all galaxy properties only depend on the mass. And the concentration, at best, is essentially just set as the average from simulations. This has even only been done recently, that it's been put in as a function of mass and redshift. I don't think anyone's published a model with scatter. And spin parameter also is not correlated in any way with the history. So I see this as a somewhat of a big flaw in these models. I should point out that people who have done just disk formation modeling, not in this whole context of emerging history, have included correlations between concentration and spin and galaxy properties, but not using this new recipe that we've developed. So very briefly, let me mention some things that I think we're starting to learn about what sets halo spin. The standard picture is that spin is just built up by tidal torques. I think the new things that we've been learning seem to indicate that mostly spin is built up by actual merger events coming into the halo. So these are, of course, randomly accreted, and they come in with different orbital parameters. But those accreted satellites seem to affect the angular momentum a lot. So here I've plotted how the angular momentum, how this spin parameter changes from one time step to the next in a major merger. Okay, so this is the distribution of the final spin parameter over the initial spin parameter in a merger. And you can see that in all major mergers, it tends to increase by about 25%. When the spin parameter was initially quite low, it's likely that an incoming satellite will spin up the halo. If the spin parameter is initially quite high, then just since it's not likely to be going in the same direction, it's likely to spin down the halo. So, and there's also a weak correlation between lambda and this formation parameter, which is essentially you can understand by the correlation between this formation parameter and merging history. Right? But there's still a large scatter for a given formation parameter, and that's essentially due to the fact that this is a random walk process.
So in this model, you have little halos coming in and creating, and the angular momentum of the whole thing is just whatever random angular momentum had initially plus some random angular momentum. And the new angular momentum is always random.
Well, it comes in, it has some, well, it, so these plots are both from simulations. So these plots are both actually looking at the spin parameter of halos in a merger, right? If you want to model that, then yes, I mean, so it's coming in with, so you have to put in a distribution of orbital parameters of your incoming satellites. But then it is essentially random after that.
Have you checked the angular momentum of the accreted stuff? It's not related to angular momentum.
There doesn't seem to be a strong correlation. I don't feel like we have fully worked out this picture at all. And
see, this picture would tell me, but it was random. That means that halos, more massive halos would have smaller lambdas. Mm-hmm. Right? Because as you go on, everything should have averaged out to zero.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear to me what is responsible for the fact that there is no mass trend and no redshift trend in spin parameter.
You don't need a big correlation for this to have a little bit of correlation.
Yeah. Yeah.
might look random.
Right, right. I don't think we've yet effectively measured how non-random it is. I think these simulations are just sort of barely adequate to do this. Because we're doing this, as you can see, for thousands of halos. So there's work underway to look at this in smaller high resolution simulations and try to really understand what's going on. Okay, so there's a lot of information in this plot. What I've done here is taken sort of a standard vanilla semi-analytic model developed by Rachel Somerville, and which predicts a large number of observable galaxy properties. And I've put in this recipe for the concentration. Okay. So here in this plot, I'm still using extended press sector. I'm still using the normal merger tree history. The main change is that instead of just setting the concentration of a halo at random, I'm setting that concentration by fitting its mass accretion history of its most massive progenitor. And you can see that a number of correlations arise just naturally from doing this. One of the main correlations here is between color and concentration. There's also seems to be a correlation between spin parameter and concentration. I should say, for the lambda, what I put in was essentially a weak trend with AC, like we saw in that previous plot. So there are also trends of the stellar mass and of metallicity. And these are just the joint distribution of all these other parameters. So, just to remind you, all the modeling that's been done in the past, none of these correlations have existed at all. So this might have some implications for this problem that I mentioned. This is essentially that same plot that I showed you before of the data on low surface brightness galaxies. And the point that I want to make here is when I select, so I made an attempt to select halos of the relevant mass range and halos that would have been defined as low surface brightness. And when I do that, it's fairly easy to make sort of sensible cuts and get roughly 40% lower concentrations. Now, 40% lower is not, it's not, two sigma, right? It's not going to help you if this problem is more severe. But it's definitely an effect. And I think if you look at this particular parameter, that effect is essentially enough to get you down to this line, and it looks like this data is now fairly consistent. One way to look for whether this trend is actually in the data is to look at residuals, at the correlation between Tully Fisher residual and color. So this basic picture would predict that red galaxies would be more concentrated and would rotate faster for a given luminosity. And there seems to be some recent observational evidence for this. My understanding of the literature seems to be fairly controversial. There has been some evidence for this for a long time, but people have disagreed about it. From what I understand, people still disagree a little bit about this data. I'll show you some new data in a second. Essentially, the idea here is that these very red galaxies are rotating faster, right? So they're offset a whole magnitude in the Tully-Fisher relation. I also find that halos without recent disruptions, which could plausibly be disks, have a smaller scatter in CVIR than the entire population. Okay, so the scatter is about 25% when I look at halos that haven't had a merger since redshift 1. This is just a bit more data. This is some very nice data that Stéphane Courteau just let me show. So this is just a Tully-Fisher relation for his data, and these points are color coded by type. So one of the things that you can see in this plot is that these green points, which are very early types, seem to be systematically offset high to higher rotation velocities. This plot is reversed from the last plot, right? So this is rotation velocity, and this is magnitude. These late-type galaxies seem to have systematically lower rotation velocities. And there's also a trend. This plot's the residual, so d log v, the offset from this line versus color. So just concentrate on the upper right-hand panel. It's, you know, I should point out this data does not have a very wide range in color, so it's slightly hard to see this, but there does seem to be some trend there. One of the reasons that this trend has been hard to see, especially any kind of trend with color, is that most Tully Fisher samples only have a very small range of redshifts. So just to show you that plot that I showed before, this was an example that James did for the effect of tilted lambda CDM, which shifts this line over here. So that's I think about 50% lower concentrations. I think excluding, so this is for all halos. So if I include only the ones that should be in this relation, I think it's going to be probably about halfway in between those two lines. So I'm not sure that it solves the problem completely, but it certainly gets you in the right direction. Okay, so I just want to briefly discuss what the other data from other types of galaxies looks like, because most of the problems that seem to be with halo concentration seem to be for very small galaxies. And this is a recent galaxy measurement. It's only one galaxy, but it's definitely an interesting point. We need to see more. So this is X-ray observation of a giant elliptical in which they've measured the X-ray profile, and it seems to have very high concentration for its rotation velocity. I think that I'm at this point slightly confused by the lensing results. Maybe there are a couple people in this room who know more than I do about it. But it seems that many of the results from lensing are indicating very steep central slopes, but there are some indications from Keaton that halos are too concentrated still. So I think there's some kind of scale problem, and I'm not sure exactly how to resolve it. I just made this compilation of some of the data that exists on clusters. I just put this paper appeared last night on AstroPH. So this is what the data looks like for clusters. This sample of clusters is not in any way homogeneously selected, but most of these things are very relaxed clusters. So I would expect that relaxed clusters would have slightly more concentrated halos than the average for a given mass. So the errors on these things are still quite large. But the main point is that not all, but at least 80% of these authors are essentially saying that NFW profiles work very well, and they seem to have, if anything, slightly high concentrations. So this problem doesn't seem to be existing on a cluster size scale. So really suppressing the small scale power, something like, you know, having something like self-interacting dark matter would predict very, very low concentrations and flat cores for clusters. And it doesn't look like the data is consistent with that.
The self-interacting dark matter do that on cluster scales?
I think it does. I don't know. There may be ways to arrange it where it doesn't. I think most of the basic predictions have suggested that it does lower the concentrations on cluster scales. Of course, there's also a shape problem with self-interacting dark matter, which may be the most serious problem, that they're too round. Okay, so that's it. So the main thing that I want to say is that I think we now really have a physically motivated and fairly well-tested recipe for setting the halo concentration. And and not only for its trends with mass and redshift, but also for its distribution. And we've only really tested it well in one cosmology. It's been tested for of order 10 halos on, you know, in a number of other cosmologies. It's not clear how well this recipe works for warm dark matter, for example. I think we really still need to look into that. So regardless of what your cosmological model is and whether you think what I said about galaxies has anything to do with anything, this model I think is really fairly solid. But I think that it's fairly well understood that the mass accretion history should relate to the star formation history, and so this correlation between halo assembly and structure really implies a correlation between halo structure and galaxy type. And as far as I can tell, it really does seem to explain fairly well C of M over a wide range of galaxy types and mass scales. I don't know that this is the full solution to the concentration problem, but it does have an effect, and selection effects are really key. And just in terms of the future of galaxy formation modeling, I think including these effects is important to make progress.
About this bullet thing lowering the primordial spectrum.
Yeah.
Is it presumably we're talking about the spectrum on the mass scale of the galaxy that we're thinking of?
That's right.
So I mean that would make the epoch of formation later.
That's right.
But is it obvious why it does anything to the density profile?
Well, if you believe that the density profile is set by the epoch of formation, which I tried to convince you that it was, then changing the epoch of formation changes the density profile. Now, this basic model has been tested for not for thousands of halos, but for of order 10 halos, for scale-free cosmologies, for open CDM and this basic model, and also for things with different sigma 8s. And this basic model that the formation time sets the concentration seems to really work. So here this was just lowering sigma 8. So there you're just lowering the whole thing. Here I'm also putting in a tilt. Right. But anything that you do to the power spectrum, I mean, it's essentially going to predict something for the formation times, and I think that the relation between those formation times and concentration is fairly well established now.
But Moore and all did the simulation where they showed a picture of a simulated halo with the medium power spectrum with all the little small-scale structure blobs, and then they simulated the same. They did the same simulation to cut off all the subgalactic power.
Yeah.
And they had the same density profile, rho of R.
They have the same concentration. The exact same density profile.
I don't know how exact, but it looks very similar.
Mm-hmm.
That was the claim.
So what did they do? They just took out the substructure?
Yeah. So it's different than It's very different.
So what does that actually do, taking out this, just taking it out?
Just cut out the small scale power. And what they find is that you still get an NFW profile.
But...
And so the argument is that the large scale profile, the rho of R for the halo, doesn't care about the existence of substructure.
How did they take it out? They took it out at redshift zero,
resimulated. Positive the power spectrum.
Oh, they just cut the power spectrum. Okay.
It's been done for warm dark matter by several other groups.
Right.
General result. whatever you do, whatever your neutrino mass is, it makes no difference
to the concentrations,
the
yeah.
profile of it, or the concentration.
But that's really different than lowering the power on galactic scales,
yeah.
right?
That's different.
Yeah, which is essentially what affects.
Because if you lower the power, then these objects are going to generally form later.
Right.
And so they'll virialize the.
Right. So taking out the substructure with that kind of method essentially doesn't really affect the formation time.
Right.
Right. So that's. I mean, you know, we also.
The wonder of matter certainly does. So.
It affects the formation of the smallest object.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But of
so
say of a halo.
Have
your emergent tree is different, but is the mass accretion history of the most massive progenitor different?
We should talk about massive stuff here. So.
Yeah.
That
didn't I didn't tell you actually anything about the concentrations of objects once they become subhalos, which I would like to tell you about, but I can't yet do.